Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over 3 months ago, we learned about the first COVID case in the United States, and frontline workers are still demanding basic protections like masks. Frontline workers, now called essential workers, are also demanding living wages, paid time off, health care, and other basic protections. Essential workers are some of the lowest paid workers in this country. We are kicking off today's show by talking about janitors, and then later in the show, we'll continue our coverage of meatpacking workers. This country's 2.4 million janitors are working on the front lines in places like hospitals, grocery stores, and airports. Janitors are disinfecting everything. In a Time's Up video, many say that they're being forced to use unfamiliar, high-powered disinfectant without any guidelines on how to use it safely. Workers say they do not feel protected. Denise Capote, a janitor and member of SEIU Chapter 6 in Washington, said, quote, "I wash my hands every time I take my gloves off, about 20 times a day. What scares me about COVID is dying without having anything to leave behind for my loved ones," end quote. Well, joining us now to talk about how the COVID-19 crisis is impacting janitors are two guests. Iris Altamirano is the president of the Service Employees International Union Local 26 chapter in Minnesota. They represent over 8,000 janitors, security officers, window cleaners, and airport cleaners. Iris is the proud daughter of an immigrant janitor. Hi, Iris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We are also joined by Marcos Aranda. Marcos works in San Francisco as a janitor, as a member of SEIU 1021. Hi, Marcos. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Well, Iris, I want to start off with you by honoring Armando Solis, a member of your union. Armando was 55. He was a janitor for 10 years at the U.S. Bank Plaza in downtown Minneapolis. And he tragically died from COVID-19 on April 22nd, leaving behind a wife and two sons. What can you tell us about Armando?
As you mentioned, Armando had been an active union member for 10 years. He actually helped to lead the first worker and climate strike in the U.S. We held it on February 27th of 2020. And just a week later, we were able to negotiate and land the best contract that commercial janitors have had in the Twin Cities ever. And so he played a big part in that. He was a striking janitor. He had U.S. Bank Plaza at a majority. And as you mentioned, he left behind a wife and two sons. One of his sons is wheelchair bound. And I actually just got off the phone with his other son this morning. And so he's our first. Unfortunately, we know that this crisis is so serious that we know there'll be more.
You talked about the work that he did with the one-day strike, and this strike gave janitors a $2.20 wage increase, more paid sick days, reduced cost health insurance, and we'll talk about that a little later in the show. Iris, according to reports, no one can say for sure where Armando came in contact with the coronavirus. Do you have any idea if he had the protective gear that he needed?
So we have reports that the company had been providing masks. The issue here, though, is that it's inadequate. They'll give one mask. As you know, one mask is for a one-time use. And so, you know, there's just a quagmire here because some companies are providing masks, but then some are providing them inadequately or not the right ones. We need the N95.
What has testing been like for janitors in your area? Is it available?
So we had a breakthrough in Minnesota where our governor announced that there was going to be a massive ability to be able to test. As you know, there's just a disparity in access to our healthcare system. My union is majority women, majority immigrant. majority people of color. And, you know, this crisis is highlighting just how broken our systems have been and just how broken they continue to be, and even more so now. So what we're finding is that, to our knowledge, we have 10 members who are showing symptoms or have been diagnosed with COVID-19. But in some cases, there's no test available. And if there's no test available, then it's very difficult to get that positive test, which then kicks in all of the new Family Medical Leave Act and the CARES Act worker protections. Like, for example, FMLA or family medical leave.
Right. Marcos, you're a janitor in San Francisco. You're a member of SEIU 1021. What is the situation like for janitors here in San Francisco? Do you have access to tests?
No, we do not. The only people I know being tested are people who are showing symptoms. That's the only people I know who are getting tested. I haven't heard of anybody else being tested without actually showing any symptoms.
What about protective gear? Are you given protective gear on a regular basis?
Yeah, we are given protective gear, but the mask is the same thing. We're getting maybe one a day.
Wow.
Even when they're putting orders for more, the places are sold out. There's no, you know, people have had to provide their own masks.
And Iris, I read in one report that you actually had to dip into your own budget to purchase thousands of masks and gloves.
That's correct. We were able to find a place, and we're hopeful that we will be getting them in this week.
Marcos, can you just explain to us, you know, in terms of janitors, you're a member of SEIU 1021 in San Francisco. Are most janitors members of unions? And do most of you work for independent companies, or do you work directly for the corporation?
Usually independent companies. I know very few in-house who are for the corporation.
So you work for an independent company that then contracts with the corporation?
That's what, for the most part, yes.
Okay.
So and so the technical term is it's a subcontracted cleaning company.
Okay, and is that the same in Minnesota, Iris?
Yes, because we have the same model. You know, the Justice for Janitors campaign was something that, you know, SEIU led across the country. And so we're very fortunate to have what we call, you know, union towns or wall-to-wall union density. And so San Francisco has union density, like where Marcos works. St. Paul and Minneapolis have union density, like the workers that I represent. And so it's a subcontracted company.
So if you are working for a subcontracted company, but you do also have union protections, Iris, can you tell us what rights do janitors have in Minnesota?
So, you know, we, through our contractual collective bargaining agreement, we have a ton of protections, some that you had already mentioned, some like Marcos mentioned, right, that it is the companies, this subcontracted companies, contractual obligation to provide those masks. It is not on the union to provide the appropriate personal protective equipment for the workers. Now, I'm leading by example, and I know a lot of unions have done it because it is so important and because it is our members who need them. And so, you know, we are just trying to do the best that we can and stretch the resources that we have, but also have to hold these companies to task and hold them accountable on what they're not only contractually obligated to do, but have to follow state and federal, you know, governmental agency guidelines.
Because in many cases, Iris, we're talking about major corporations here, right?
Yes. Fortune 500 companies.
Right, multinational corporations.
Yes.
Marcos, can you tell us what has really changed for you as a janitor since the COVID outbreak? In the Time's Up video that I was watching, many of the women said that they are now forced to use high-powered disinfectants that are full of chemicals, and they did not get any guidelines on how to use it safely.
What we've used is, I believe, they're medical-grade disinfectants. The only instructions I read were on the bottle itself. I did what I could. I wore gloves whenever using it so that I didn't touch it with my bare skin. I'm not sure how my skin would react to it.
What else has changed for you? Oh, go ahead, Iris. What's happening in your area?
Yep. So in our case, with regard to the gloves, our janitors are being given restaurant gloves to clean bathrooms. They're so thin that it's like you're giving nothing.
Restaurant gloves to use these high-powered chemicals?
Yep.
So what happens when you go to the corporation and say, our workers need thicker gloves, actual gloves for janitors, and more protective equipment? What is the response?
We're trying. The demand, we can't get them. We're trying. And in some cases, if it's so important, you do it.
Wow. Marcos, what about with you? Do you mind telling us what company you work for? I mean, if not, it's okay. But what happens when you request better equipment?
I work with Able Services. For the most part, my specific manager, he's been good at ordering the things. But the thing we always get, sometimes we get it's out of stock. I'm not sure how everybody else is doing on, the PPE. It's also scarce. The supplies are scarce. There's not too much of it.
That is Marcos Aranda. He works in San Francisco as a janitor. He's actually a member of SEIU Local 87. We're also joined by Iris Altamirano, president of SEIU's Local 26 chapter in Minnesota. They represent over 8,000 janitors, security officers, window cleaners, and airport cleaners. Iris is the daughter of an immigrant janitor. We are also honoring the life of Armando Solis, a member of Iris's union. Armando was 55, and he tragically died from COVID on April 22nd, leaving behind his wife and two sons. He was a janitor for 10 years at the U.S. Bank Plaza in downtown Minneapolis. If you have any questions or comments for Marcos or Iris, if you are a janitor and would like to share your story, or if you work with janitors, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Marcos, when we put out a call to ask for someone to join us, we had a hard time because so many janitors have been laid off. Can you talk about what that has been like for your colleagues and friends who are janitors who've lost their jobs?
I've been lucky. I've been able to work until now. I'm not sure how much more work we're gonna have. But I've gotten calls from people that I know, and they're calling me. I've had people crying. They cried because they have nothing in the fridge, nothing to eat. They don't know how they're gonna get by. They've cried. Some don't qualify for unemployment, and they're really struggling. I know that a lot of them are there's the rent thing to help out with rent so that you don't have to pay, but a lot of them don't understand how it works, so they're afraid not to pay the rent if they can't. They feel like they're gonna go homeless. It's not something that our janitors are used to. A lot of them are not even used to asking for money. They prefer to find a job instead of going on unemployment. They're very prideful. It's been tough on a lot of families.
So when they lose their janitorial jobs, there's no protection, there's no paid time off, there's no sick leave?
No, for the most part, no. If you have vacation time, you'll be lucky. If you can, they might allow you to use that. I heard some people saying that they weren't allowed to access your own, vacation time, even if you had it. They should have been extended leaves for, if you had a certain amount of hours for sick leave, you can only take a certain amount, about three off without an actual doctor's note. They should be allowed to use any type of sick time they have, so that if they're at risk, so that they can stay home and feel safe, be safe.
And Iris, sadly, people who are undocumented cannot apply for unemployment benefits. Just a few states have even, put forward a plan. And for example, in California, there's a plan to provide $500 to immigrant families, but that doesn't pay rent.
I mean, I think that, part of leading in a time like this is also understanding our limitations. And, I know that, even the masks that I bought, that's not enough, and it's not a long-term solution, So I know that we're all just trying to do our best, but, people are dying from us not being able to have the vision to look beyond just healthcare workers, who are very important essential workers, but that's on the back end of this problem. And if we had the vision, and our elected officials and everyone had the vision to look further down the line and recognize how uniquely positioned janitors are to kill this virus from the very beginning before it gets us sick. That's what my fight is to push people to have vision, to look further down, to make sure that our resources protect all workers, not just the ones on the back end and on the front line, but on the front end and on the front line.
Right, because these are the janitors that are keeping everything clean, and in many cases using these chemicals cleaner with a lot of extra chemicals, and in many cases not being trained. Iris, again, I'm trying to understand, so many of the janitors are members of SEIU unions across the country, but they don't have health care, and if they are laid off,
so
or maybe
these are contractually negotiated benefits, and so it just depends, on what the each local union is able to negotiate on behalf of the members, but then also what the member bargaining committee is able to land. And so, like in here at Local 26, our members do have access to health insurance. Do they all take it? There's agency involved with that, right? But it is a value of our union to have affordable, accessible health insurance.
That is Iris Altamirano, president of SEIU Local 26 chapter in Minnesota. We're also joined by Marcos Aranda. Marcos works in San Francisco as a janitor and is a member of SEIU Local 87. If you have any questions, comments, if you have a story to share, we'd love to hear from you. The country's janitors are really working on the front lines because they're keeping places clean, hospitals, grocery stores, airports, and they are using now very heavy disinfectants. And a lot of workers say they do not feel protected. Yesterday, there was a town hall with frontline workers, and Joe Biden joined that town hall. He said he supports a $13 an hour raise for all essential workers. This would be an additional $13 an hour. So in many cases, it would double people's wages. Iris, I have not heard of what he's talking about. Is this something that is going to be introduced? Do you know of this?
I know that there's been a lot of push on behalf of unions to have what we're calling, hazard pay or premium pay. I wish that would be something that this country could really pull off, but I have my doubts.
Right. Well, especially with given the party that is in power right now, the Republican Party. Iris, we read that on average janitors make about $15 an hour. Is that right?
I would say that's about right. You know, we are very fortunate to make more than that, and our one-day strike in February really put us on a path for, as you mentioned, the $2 and 20-cent raise over 4 years.
One worker in the Time's Up video said she only gets 2 sick days. How common is this, Iris?
So I can't speak on behalf of, you know, that worker, but again, that's probably what was able to be negotiated through the contractual agreement. Our one-day strike assured that workers in the Twin Cities, all property service workers in the Twin Cities, had access to 6 sick days. And so my contract has 6 for all workers.
So that's six sick days a year?
That's right.
And what about vacation time?
We have the most in the country.
Wow. What about vacation
time? We have the
time?
Most sick, okay, yep, we have the most sick days guaranteed through our contractual agreement in the country for our janitors. And for vacation time, it's accrued, and it just depends on how much time folks have. Our maximum scale is 5 weeks.
What about you, Marcos? What about janitors in San Francisco?
Well, we can accumulate sick pay. We can accumulate, I'm not sure what the cap is right there, but it's a good amount. I believe it's over 200, maybe 300 hours. Vacations also, we could accumulate through the years. I don't believe we have any cap on the vacation time. We have members who have tons of sick hours, but, you know, weren't allowed to use all of them because they would need a doctor's note to take more than 4 days off. Yet a lot of them, you know, needed it. And so, you know, because a lot of them suffered from anxiety, because of the fear of, you know, contracting the virus. They should have been, allowed to use it if, you know, maybe not, you know, if there was no, threat, but I think at a time of, you know, of risk, they should be allowed to, you know, use it, whatever they have to stay safe.
Marcos, I think that's you with children in the background. Is that right?
Yes, I have a big family. I live at home with my wife, 6 kids. I also have my sister living here with her 2 kids and my mother.
What do you do, Marcos? I mean, when you go out during the day and do this front line, I mean, right on the front lines, cleaning things with heavy disinfectant, what do you do to ensure that you stay safe? Because, you know, we've been hearing from healthcare workers who are sleeping in the garage or just taking every precaution they can to make sure they don't give anything to their families. What do you do? What is that like for you?
Well, coming in at, you know, I'm coming in at, you know, at night, late at night when everyone's asleep. So I'm kind of happy about that. I don't really get to see them right away. So what I do is I'll come in, take my shoes off and head straight to the shower. You know, my clothes is being washed daily. It's ripping, starting to rip because of so much, you know, so much going through the washer daily. You know, I try to mop after myself where I've stepped just in case I, you know, had some on my bottom of my shoe. It's, you know, I also do the same before leaving. If I, you know, before leaving to work in case.
Marcos, before we let you go, what changes would you like to see for San Francisco's janitors?
Me? I would like them to have a proper PPE, proper protection, protection on job security. That would be great. You know, a lot of them suffered from layoffs and are still suffering from it. And also, you know, essential pay for those who are at risk. Who are still going today, going to work every day? They're at risk. One of the things I realized during this is that we're essential, but we're also invisible. We're not seen. I saw the healthcare workers. I saw fast food workers all getting thanked, all getting all types of you know, donations for PPE. Yet we weren't seen. We weren't given much. We were left to fend for ourselves, basically.
Well, Marcos, we thank you for your work, and we would love to have a few of your friends and colleagues on the show who have lost their jobs so we can hear their stories. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the important work that you do.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for announcing us.
Yeah, we'll call you soon to get in touch with some of your friends, if you don't mind, because we'd love to have them on the show.
Okay. I'll give them a shout-out.
All right. Thank you so much, Marcos. Marcos Aranda works in San Francisco as a janitor. He is a member of SEIU Local 87. Iris, before we let you go, what changes would the janitors that you represent, what changes would they like to see?
The same as Marcos, the appropriate and adequate PPE for all workers, and premium pay, essential worker pay. They're doing superhero work, and they're keeping us safe, and it is our obligation to do the same for them.
Well, we will definitely do a show about PPE and protective worker pay. I really want to get more information about this $13 an hour raise for all essential workers that Joe Biden says he supports. Iris, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Iris Altamirano is president of SEIU Local 26, the chapter in Minnesota. They represent over 8,000 janitors, security officers, window cleaners, and airport cleaners. And once again, we want to honor Armando Solis, a member of the union. He was a janitor for 10 years at the U.S. Bank Plaza in downtown Minneapolis. He tragically died from COVID on April 22nd, leaving behind a wife and two sons. Coming up after a break, we will continue our coverage of the coronavirus outbreaks in meatpacking plants across the country. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are continuing our coverage of widespread COVID outbreaks in meat processing plants across the country. At least 31 plants owned by Smithfield, JBS, and Tyson have had coronavirus outbreaks. According to the CDC, COVID has infected workers in 115 meat and poultry processing facilities across 19 states. According to the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, over 6,500 workers have tested positive or have been quarantined. At least 22 have died. The Latino civil rights organization LULAC is asking people to boycott corporate beef, pork, poultry, and eggs for the month of May. I thought it was March. It is May. I'm losing my days. Over the weekend in Crete, Nebraska, the children of meat processing workers were protesting while their parents were resting. One sign read, "You need meat for 2 weeks. I need my parents alive." Later in the show, we will be joined by Veronica. Her mom tested positive for COVID a few days ago and believes she was infected at work at a food processing facility. Joining us now is Dr. Angela Stisi, a cultural anthropologist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She is the author of Scratching Out a Living, Latinos, Race, and Work in the Deep South. The book explores how new Latino migration into Mississippi's poultry industry has impacted communities and prospects for worker organizing. And Dr. Stisi joins us from North Carolina. Hi, Dr. Stisi. Thanks so much for joining us again. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks again for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I want to ask you, Dr. Stisi, a general question about frontline essential workers. You know, it's been 3 months now, and there is so much fantastic reporting at the national level about these workers and about the fact that they get paid so little, they have so few rights, and a lot of people are saying that this is the time for labor. Based on what we're learning, Dr. Stacey, and we're finally hearing from these frontline workers, what changes do you what do you think it'll take to actually create the major change that is needed for these workers?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Listen, I do, you know, you say this has been going on for 3 months, and yes, we've been seeing this coming. It's feeling increasingly urgent to me, even since we last spoke, which was like, I think less than 2 weeks ago. Over the weekend, I lost a friend to COVID who was a poultry worker leader in Mississippi. And speaking with his family, who called me to tell me the news, they just said it's everywhere in their community. They said that when one person in the family went to the hospital to identify, his body, that the doctor sort of motioned around and said, look at all these people. They're all from the chicken plants. I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg here when it comes to the, sort of the devastation in poultry and meatpacking communities. So I wanted to take a minute to recognize Celso Mendoza and the incredible work that he did in organizing his plant. And maybe we can talk more about that later. But I'm hopeful that if anything, you know, good can come out of all of this, that it could be a moment when workers can come together and demand better working conditions and compensation.
I'm so sorry to hear about your friend. Just to add to that, Angela, Dr. Sharon Duclos, co-medical director of the People's Community Health Clinic in Black Hawk County, Iowa, she, during a press conference, was crying, just talking about what it's like to ask her colleagues to come to work every day. She said the exact same thing on MSNBC last night, that they just kept seeing people in their clinic over and over again, and they are meat processing workers. And a number of epidemiologists and scientists say that in the next couple of weeks, we're going to see the ripple effect of this, how when these meatpacking workers go home and possibly infect their families, and then their family member goes to work, it just keeps spreading.
That's right. That's right. And it's, you know, mostly working people and Black and brown people that are being affected, even in states that have a, you know, much higher percentage of white residents. You know, people on the front lines in the hospitals are saying that their patients are overwhelmingly people of color. Mm.
So as you said, Dr. Stacey, this has gotten worse since we had you on a couple of weeks ago. We know what's happening now. Workers in meat processing plants, and again, these are billion-dollar corporations, JBS, Smithfield, Tyson, they did not have the protective gear that they needed. So many of them are getting sick. Many of them are dying. Let's talk about where we are right now. The New York Times had a piece, "Powerful Meat Industry Holds More Sway After Trump's Order. The executive action signals that decisions around whether to close or reopen plants should be driven by the federal government, not local authorities." So can you tell us about the executive order which allows the Department of Agriculture to invoke the Defense Production Act? According to the New York Times, it doesn't explicitly mandate that plants stay open, but it signals that the decisions around whether to close or reopen a plant should be driven by the federal government, not local authorities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I, after learning about the Trump's invocation of the Defense Production Act, I tried to learn a little bit more about it. I know that it's been around for about 70 years, and it's been used throughout that time by different presidents to support national security and safety interests related to the Korean War, to the Cold War, to cyber espionage more recently. But I think what we see in Trump's executive order is a different logic entirely. And what I see happening is that the president is in effect enacting an executive bailout of this industry, which perhaps coincidentally or perhaps not is an industry that has aggressively supported him and the Republican Party for years. So there's sort of this constellation of things that come together, that came together last week, Rose. Before he announced the invocation of this act, we know that Trump administration officials engaged in private conversations with executives of major meat processing companies. And then within a span of a few days, Tyson Foods put out this full-page ad in several very high-profile national papers warning of supply shortages. The CDC and OSHA then issued new guidance for the industry, and President Trump indicated that he would be signing an executive order to address quote-unquote liability problems in the food supply. So I think even before the DPA was invoked, we got this clue that this was related to questions of liability for protecting the meat and poultry industry from, workers who get sick and who get ill and die, right? The liability that they could have by forcing them back to work.
The New York Times reports that the action by the Trump administration followed weeks of lobbying behind the scenes and in public by companies like Tyson, actually led by Tyson, according to the Times. This is a beef, pork, and chicken processor that generates $40 billion in annual revenue. $40 billion in annual revenue. We are talking about very powerful, profitable companies. The Times reports that the leverage that these giant companies have exerted on both Republican and Democratic administrations stems largely from their role in supplying the nation with food. Plus, as you've written about, after decades of consolidation, only a very small group of slaughterhouses concentrated in the Midwest accounts for the bulk of the country's meat supply.
Yeah, so everything that you've just said sort of underscores the power that this industry has, and I think the this constellation of the CDC and OSHA and Trump's invocation of this Defense Production Act is essentially ensuring one principal goal, which is that these multinational giants can keep running the processing lines at the lowest possible cost. And, we know that this isn't only exactly what the industry wants, but from studying this industry for many years, I also know that it's what they've always done. Just keep running the lines.
Well, and it related to that, I mean, we've talked about the hundreds of thousands of animals that are being euthanized. According to the New York Times, the meat industry was helped over the weekend when another powerful constituency weighed in, farmers who expect that they will need to euthanize as many as 150,000 pigs a day because the slaughterhouses remain closed, also pushed for federal intervention. And yesterday we just talked about the power of these massive, massive farmers who are receiving the bulk of the bailout, not the small farmers.
Wow, that's interesting. I can see how it's in their interest to get these animals off to the slaughtering plants and not euthanizing them on the farms. This is reminding me of a little bit of when Hurricane Katrina hit the Mississippi Gulf Coast and then moved its way through Mississippi. And I was living there working with the Mississippi Poultry Workers Center at the time. And at least in the case of Mississippi poultry farmers, poultry growers, they are still, in many cases, families that go into great debt in order to get these contracts with the big processors. And what they learned, or what became really clear after Katrina, is they don't own the chicks. The chicks are dropped off, in the case of chickens, dropped off on their farms. They don't own them. They just raise them, and then they're paid based on the chickens then going off to slaughter. But after Katrina, when, chicken houses were destroyed and millions of chickens ended up dying on the farms, at the moment that those chickens die, they become property of the farmers. And so my suspicion, although I don't know as much about pork processing, is that there may be similar sorts of clauses in contracts, right, where the farmers, if they have to euthanize the animals on the farm, then they're taking a big hit.
Well, we are going to do a week-long series about all of these major meat companies because I think for a lot of people, they're hearing about JBS for the first time ever. This is one of the largest meat companies in the world. It's run by Josely Batista and his family in Brazil. The Washington Post has a piece about the company getting $78 million in U.S. government pork contracts, more than any other pork producer. We're also going to do a show about Smithfield. Grain reports Smithfield made $1.4 billion in profits last year. And then Tyson, still owned by the Tyson family. The Motley Fool reports Tyson's second quarter revenues were $10.9 billion. So we're going to do shows about all of these major corporations in the coming weeks. Dr. Angela Stisi is a cultural anthropologist at the University of North Carolina and author of Scratching Out a Living, Latinos, Race, and Work in the Deep South. Now I would like to welcome Veronica to the show. Veronica graduated with a degree in political science and Latin American studies. She works at a nonprofit as a director of equity and inclusion. Her mom tested positive for COVID a few days ago and believes she was infected at work at a food processing facility. Hi, Veronica. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to thank LULAC because yesterday I watched LULAC's town hall and you were one of the speakers along with other children of meat processing workers. And I thought it was just really powerful. Can you talk about how you connected with other children of meat processing plant workers to speak out for your parents?
Yeah. I'm really grateful to LULAC for that opportunity and connecting us with that opportunity and this opportunity. So, oddly enough, I actually went to the University of Iowa with Edgardo, who was also a speaker yesterday. So we both went to school at Iowa. We were involved in Greek life, have mutual friends, and we actually hadn't really connected in the last couple of years. And so I told him I was really happy that, I was able to reconnect with him, although I wish it would have been under different circumstances. And the other two people who were on with us, I actually don't know them, but I haven't met them in person, but we connected online and have been talking. And yesterday we were just, I think, just kind of processing, and I told them I was really grateful that we, somehow in the midst of all of this, we've been able to connect. And there's a lot of different things that we relate to. So.
One of the things that struck me about what you all said is that in many cases, your parents are afraid to speak out for fear of retribution. Another young person on the call said that her mom, in several meetings, is told by executives, well, if you don't like it, you can just leave.
Yep. Yes. So the place where my mom works is a lot smaller than, these big names like Tyson and Smithfield and JBS. But she has worked at plants in the past. And my father actually worked for JBS in Marshalltown for probably 25 years. And so he worked there for quite a long time. And I mean, the reason he left, was exactly because of, what's going on right now, the just terrible work conditions, just the pressure, the mental stress, the physical work, just getting repetitive stress injuries. And he was like, if I don't leave this now, I feel like I will never be able to leave. And so he left, I believe in 2016, So when I see all of these things and I see so many of my community members getting sick, it's really no surprise to me. Of course this was going to happen, especially because of the work conditions, because of the way they treat people, because of the lack of concern for people and their health. So this really isn't surprising. It's awful.
Veronica, can you tell us a little bit more about just what is involved in the work that your parents do? What is a day like? What's in terms of their body? Like your father said, I can't do this anymore because it's taking such a toll on my body. And then what, if any, protections do they have?
Well, my dad, was experiencing a lot of just repetitive stress injuries from being at the plant for so many years. So his shoulder was hurting, just excruciating pain. I remember he had like an arm brace on for a little while. And I mean, there was just a number of things. Just physically, it was just taxing for him. Just long hours, especially when he would work overtime. And just the treatment, I think that was honestly just the worst part. Like, I remember there was an incident where he had like an extra pair of gloves in his locker that he picked up off the floor, and they were like, oh, you were trying to steal, company equipment. And he was like, what? No, I just picked them up. And I remember they suspended him and, without pay, and even had like security guards escort him off, property. And I was just absolutely livid because I was like, are you kidding me? Why would you, like, this doesn't make sense to treat somebody in this manner over something as silly as gloves, and to treat an employee of over 20 years in this way. Like, what, how humiliating is that? Like, why would you do that? I don't see any logical reasoning behind that. And so I was really upset. I remember calling human resources and trying to get like a copy of like the policy, the handbook. I just wanted to see where it said that, you know, what his actions warranted this type of response and why he was going to be suspended without pay. And of course they weren't very happy about that, but luckily I was able to find some, you know, get some type of response from the company. He was supposed to be suspended for 3 days and he was able to go back to work. But I remember, him being like scared. He was like, you know, I really don't like it when you do these things. Like, I don't, you know, I don't want to cause any trouble. Like, you think this is easy for you just to, you know, speak out, but you never know what it's going to be like for me at work. And I'm like, okay, you're right, but it's not okay for them to treat you like this over something so silly. Mm. So, I mean, just a lot of different scenarios like that I remember, just being younger and hearing things that made me upset. And then just as I got older, and just more knowledgeable, trying to advocate for him as much as I could while obviously respecting, his wishes, because he's right. I don't know what it's like to work in a facility like that. And I don't know what type of repercussions, he would be facing, or, you know, hostility. So, yeah.
And Veronica, I wanted to also ask about your mom. We're almost out of time, but your mom tested positive for COVID, as she believed she was infected at work. She went to urgent care twice and was told she had a common cold. She now is home, luckily. How is she doing right now?
She is doing much better. She is still hooked up to oxygen, but she is doing much better. She said she still struggles with like headaches and just some shortness of breath, and she said she feels weak, but that she feels much, much, much better than she did when she was hospitalized, or, you know, leading up until then. So we're grateful that she is home now.
And is she getting sick pay?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Is she getting sick pay?
Oh, no, of course not. I called, being me, I called and they were like, oh no, we only pay people for the work that they do, which is, you know, an interesting way of saying that they aren't going to pay people right now. And there is sick pay, but it's only after like a certain amount of time of being there. And I wasn't really given a clear answer, but the only thing I did understand very clearly is that she would not be receiving any type of pay right now.
Dr. Stacey, can you jump in here and talk about the power of young people like Veronica speaking out and sharing stories about their parents who are oftentimes too afraid to speak out?
Yeah, of course. Veronica, I'm so happy to hear you on here. And I know your parents must be incredibly proud of you and your activism and your unwillingness to back down. I think this is what's needed, right? We need unregulated capitalism is not going to keep workers safe. Workers and their supporters and advocates, you know, have to continue speaking up. It's the government's job to step in and regulate companies for health and safety and workers' rights to organize and basic rights to pay. And right now our president is obstructing abilities to do this. So I think it's more important than ever for people like Veronica to continue speaking out. I'm really grateful for you.
And Veronica, I mentioned in the intro that the Latino Civil Rights Organization, LULAC, again, thank them for connecting us with you, is asking people to boycott corporate beef, pork, poultry, and eggs for the month of May. And over the weekend in Nebraska, children of meat processing workers were protesting while their parents were resting, holding signs like, "You need meat for 2 weeks. I need my parents alive." Veronica, what else are you planning with other children of meat processing plant workers in the coming weeks? Anything we should know about?
I think that is really the big thing. Right now I'm connected with folks on Facebook. My colleagues that I spoke with on the town hall yesterday created a online group, Solidarity for meatpacking plant workers, for food processing workers. And so people are, you know, sharing information on their resources, and I think just really strategizing. I think it's a bit hard to strategize and also, you know, be responding to our family's needs. So I might be a little behind, especially since yesterday was such a busy day. But I think the really big thing right now is just boycotting and sending just a big economic message to these corporations, because I feel like that is the only way they that's the only language they speak.
Veronica graduated with a degree in political science and Latin American studies and now works at a nonprofit as a director of equity and inclusion. Her mom tested positive for COVID a few days ago and believes she was infected at work at a food processing facility. Luckily, she is home and doing much better. Veronica, thank you so much for joining us. We would love to have you back with a few of the other young people who spoke out for their parents and meat processing workers across the country.
Thank you so much for having me. I would love to speak
Great.
To you
Thank
again.
You. Thank you so much. And Dr. Angela Stisi is a cultural anthropologist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and author of Scratching Out a Living, Latinos, Race, and Work in the Deep South. As always, Dr. Stisi, thank you so much for joining us, and we're going to continue covering this, so we'd love to have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping the studio going. And thank you for joining us. You can find more information about today's show and read the piece that we cited from the New York Times. You can find links at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.